Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Not So Common Podcast. This week, I have a guest. He's a YouTuber with over 1.7 million subscribers. He's someone that I've known speciously for a long time. I've only spoken to him about three times, though, in the past 8 years. His name is Austin Hargrave, also known as the Peanut Butter Gamer. Welcome, Austin.
I like that, speciously.
You like that? My English lit class paying off from college.
It's got the dictionary up in the side. Speciously. I can't say I've heard that one dropped in everyday conversation recently.
Did you attend college at all?
I did, yes. I went to college for, I want to say, 2.5 years until I dropped out.
You dropped out to pursue the YouTube as a full-time career?
Yeah. I did. I talked about that before in various little places, but pretty much I was going to school. I was one of those people that just went to school because I didn't really know what else to do. Kind of got a bunch of student loan debt.
Nice. That's the American dream now.
Yeah, apparently it is. Yeah. I got a bunch of student loan debt and was going to it was UNT, University of North Texas. You know some of the Screwtech guys, like Ben, who works in Death Battle, Nick and them?
Sure.
They went to that school as well. It was just a coincidence. I just lived in that area. And I went there for a couple years. I was taking, like, radio, TV, and film classes, but mostly I didn't really know what I wanted to do. All I was really doing was YouTube videos. And eventually I decided that, I mean, I signed up with Maker around that point. Back when you had to sign up to partner with YouTube, you had to go with the network.
Well, that's when it was the Game Station?
Yeah, it was the Game Station. I think Maker Studios ran it, but it was called the Game Station. Before they moved to, called it Polaris, and now I don't even know if Polaris exists anymore. It's just kind of Maker and Maker 2 or whatever.
I remember that, because that's when, you know, they were hand-picking channels versus, you know, I guess eventually, like, Machinima and all these other MCNs would just take whoever they could. So I remember it was, like, you, it was Angry Joe, it was JonTron. And a few others where back then it was sort of the wide open frontier of, oh, now we can get monetized. The MCNs are starting to pop up before everyone can get monetized.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't have even been on Maker if I hadn't have submitted one of my videos into their contest. They did this contest where they're like, oh, we'll feature user submitted videos on our channel. And I submitted one. And it was actually the first one that they featured, like their first ever featured video for the contest. And then I was like, wow, that was amazing. I got a few hundred subscribers from that, which was huge back then. You know, back when you got like 10 subscribers and it was like, oh, what happened? Like, I blew up.
10 people, like, are watching my videos? What?
Yeah. So that happened. And then like a week or so later, they called me up and like, hey, you want to make money on your YouTube videos? And I was like, that's probably only the thing. That's only the thing I would want more than anything ever. Sure, let's do it.
Yeah. So you're a young kid at the time. You're in college.
I was probably about 18 or 19. I forget how old.
So what's interesting is that we're about 10 years apart in age, 9, 10 years, something like that. You represent to me that first generation where you could forego college and say, screw it, let's try YouTube. Because it's established enough that you could do that. So
it wasn't, I don't want to like play it up or anything. It was definitely scary. Like I was, you know, I think my first check was maybe like $100 or something. You know, it was not something that was a for sure thing. But I did get enough subscribers that I basically reached the point where I felt like if I didn't drop out of school and put my all into trying to make it work, I would really regret it in like 10, 20 years that I never gave it a try. So that's kind of why I decided to do it. Also, I didn't know what the heck I was doing in college anyway. I was just going into debt and I was living off of student loan debt. So,
But for you, it was an option though. So you're the first generation, I guess me included, that it was a viable option. For example,
true.
My friend from college has twin girls that I think they're about 10 years old now. And they are monetized, like, on YouTube through a channel for, like, there's children that vlog and do activities.
And, but you couldn't – you had to be a certain age.
Well, if you get permission, you know, it's okay. Like anything else. Get your parents, guardian's permission to do that. And to me, that's so weird that you'll have kids growing up now where we can get into the fact that TV as a form itself and cable is dying, but that's an option now for children. There's like child YouTube stars where you can make it on your own, you can get huge, and you can be known by other 5 and 6 year olds around the world. And I can't imagine that, like when I was growing up, and even you, when you're 5 and 6, the only kids that know you are the kids on your block and the kids you went to school with.
Absolutely.
That's yeah. it. Like maybe
soccer
the kid,
team.
Yeah, and the kids in the playground the next town over that would try to beat you up every now and then. Like, that was really your world, and now it's sort of opened up. So you grew up in Texas.
Yes, around the Dallas area.
Nice and hot and dusty.
Yes, yes. It's all smoky here in Seattle now, so I would take dust over smoke. Well, I just wake up with smoke on the forecast. Like, oh, great.
That or just rain 300 days a year, right? Is that true?
Not as bad as people say. It hasn't rained here in about, like, 60 days, but, I mean, I don't want to get off track. So it's the summer, though.
Is that typical, or is that climate change, you think?
I don't know about rain specifically. I don't know anything about that, but I do know that I feel like it used to rain in the summer, but I've only been here for like 4 years. I thought if you had asked me like a year or two ago, I would have said, oh, it rains in the summer, but it has not rained this summer. So I don't know why that is specifically. The smoke, I'm sure, is because of climate change, because it's fires from Canada up north, and it's the smoke's wafting down. My friend who lives here told me that he's never seen smoke before, but like the last 3 years, it's been smoke every summer. Like, it's kind of a weird thing.
Easier for brush fires to get bigger.
It's dry and
that's fine. That's fine. You can just have a nice smoky smell around your house and be like, oh, it's just part of the
barbecue,
part of the ambiance of living in Seattle now.
Apparently, yeah, in the summer, gotta get that deadly smoke from the north.
Getting back to video contests. That's the first time we ever interacted. You remember that?
Video contests?
Yes.
Did you say? My first memory of you is at SGC.
Correct.
Maybe I don't have a great memory though. So okay, I'm forgetting the contest.
Yeah, yeah, it was that was the SGC 2010.
10, yeah, had to be 10.
That was the last one before they came back a few years later and rebooted it. That was my first convention as a guest, which was fun, having 12 people in your panel on a Saturday morning. Literally 12. I don't think I'm exaggerating. But I remember talking to you. I think you were either volunteering or helping out with something at the time. And
if it was 2010, I think I was volunteering.
Yeah, and I remember we were both involved with the Game Trailers contest. Mm. Remember that?
I thought that might be what you were getting at, but I wasn't sure. Yeah.
So Game Trailers, remember back then?
That famous Game Trailers contest.
Yeah, it was like the next big star.
Yeah.
So Game Trailers was going to have this sort of reality show-esque thing where they were going to have like 8 or so content creators, I guess, submit a video, and then they were going to be like the next big, I guess, contracted user submitted person was going to be a regular feature. And then they dropped
the contest.
Yeah,
they had judges and everything.
Yeah.
They were going to like go through phases where you like went through different rounds and stuff.
Yeah, I remember having a call. I was on a line with like, I don't know if it was a COO, but I was like on a phone call with people about this big contest. It was going to be big, and then it never happened.
Yeah.
And I was always disappointed. I was like, oh, that could have been me. Oh, I could have been blown up because of Game Trailers back then in 2010. Because that was a big deal, getting featured as a user's submission back then.
Yeah, that was how I got a lot of my subscribers, through features on Screw Attack and on Game Trailers.
Yeah, that was the frontier back then, where it was like, yeah, you can get noticed on YouTube, but not really yet.
People weren't just going onto YouTube and looking for stuff. Like,
yeah,
it was...
you still had a lot of the conglomerate sites of users. For example, like that guy with the glasses, Screw Attack, where they would just combine a bunch of people together, RetroWare TV, which you were on for a very short time.
Yeah, I always felt bad about that.
you got off right when I was getting on there about. We sort of crossed paths there for like a week or two, I remember, back in like 2009 or so, or 10.
Yeah, I was excited to be on RetroWare, but it like right when I got on is when I started talking with John about doing Normal Boots, and it was like, oh no, this... Like, I wish it had happened a few weeks earlier, and I wouldn't have, like, agreed to doing this, and we're like, we're going to do our own thing, and then I always felt bad about that. Sorry, Lance.
Lance is like, damn you. Damn you, Austin.
I know he's still stewing over it.
It could have changed the trajectory of RetroWare TV forever. do you want to talk about the beginnings of Normal Boots? I remember there was a time where you, John, moved out to where you were in Texas for at least a 2 or 3 month period, and you guys tried to make a go of it out there together.
We're starting out. Well, first, like, I met John through Screw Attack. And, well, I saw him one of his videos featured on Screw Attack after I had been using it for a bit. I was like, oh, this guy's really funny. Like, he has this sort of natural, like, funny, like, delivery and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, he seems cool. So, like, I hit him up. I was like, good work on that video. I thought it was funny. And then I think he was actually impressed that I had, like, 2,000 subscribers or whatever at the time. So I think he was like, oh, wow, like, that's cool. And so he messaged me, and we, like, went on Steam and would playing, like, Team Fortress 2 a whole bunch. And he was like, hey, I was going to make this website. I think it was going to be, like, JonTronShow.com or something. And he's like, you want to be on it? And I was like, yeah, I guess so. Can we change the name, though? And he was like, yeah, so let's just, like, make our own site. We came up with a whole bunch of names. They all sucked. And Normal Boots was the one that sucked the least. So that's what we went with. And then he moved down to... I don't know why. Only a, like, 18, 19-year-old would think... I guess I... Probably 19. Only a 19-year-old would think this was a good idea. But he moved down into my efficiency apartment. So we were, like, living in just, like, this teeny little place together. And that quick... With his bird, by the way... And so we ended up moving into a slightly bigger apartment. We weren't supposed to have the bird. So we had like drills of like what we would do if they, because they were always coming into our apartment uninvited. So we had like these drills, like what do we do with the bird if people come over. But yeah, we were just working on the website there. And he was there for about 6 months, and then he went back to California.
So the idea was to make sort of a Screw Attack style site where you had contributors coming together to work on content in an environment, I guess a working environment together?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah, we basically wanted to do a sort of Screw Attack, Back Out With The Glasses kind of thing, where it's sort of like a mixture of the two channels. Like, I feel like Back Out With The Glasses was a little more individual content creator focused, which is something we wanted, but we also liked a lot of the style of the videos that Screw Attack did, so we were just like, let's just kind of do something similar to that and see what happens. But YouTube was always our big thing. We knew we had fun doing Normal Boots, but I think both of us at that time realized that YouTube was kind of going to be the new thing. And at the very least, I know I can speak for myself that I knew that no matter what happened on these other websites, and even if I was making money on Blip or something, you know, I was building up subscribers on YouTube, and that's where people were following me. So that's kind of where I was like, you know, at that point, I still wasn't like, oh, I'm going to do this for a living. I was still sort of in the mindset where I was like, my channel will grow big enough and maybe I'll get a job from it because someone will be impressed. Like, oh, wow, you were able to do all this by yourself. You know, come help us build our thing. So I was still sort of in that mindset. And so I was like, I need to build up my subscriber base. And that's kind of what my big focus was.
So you took the calculated risk of, well, we can work together on this website or else I could put all my focus into this channel individually that I think will grow up quicker and it'll be better overall.
Yeah, it was kind of weird because we wanted to build the website, but at the same time, we still were like, oh, well, we're just going to upload our videos to YouTube too. Like, so we really didn't – it was something we always had a big problem with where we wanted to do something with Normal Boots, but at the same time, we weren't willing to give up like anything too much on our YouTube channel specifically. I think for a little bit we did a weekly exclusive on the site, but that didn't last very long. So until we started just uploading onto both again.
Well, that's tough, isn't it, to have these sort of mega team websites? I mean, Normal Boots still exists today. Correct.
We don't post to the website though.
But you still, I guess, you go to like you were just at you were all at IndiePopCon.
We're kind of just like a group, yeah.
I guess the question is then, what is the place then for these associated YouTubers? How does it work? I guess, is it for meetups? Does it work for conventions? Does it work for the collaborations that happen every now and then? Is that where the advantage would still lie in 2017 versus 2010?
I think the biggest thing that Normal Boots did as a whole was it kind of helped build up a subscriber base, and we all kind of shared viewers in a sense, where it was like, you know, you followed one person and then you could see all these other people as well. And, you know, you didn't have to follow them if you didn't want to. But, you know, you were kind of almost forced to recognize these other channels as well through various collaborations and, you know, name associations and things like that. And I think that's kind of how everybody has kind of benefited the most from Normal Boost, just by, hey, they're that group of people that, like, do that Normal Boots thing. So even if you didn't really know what Normal Boots is, you knew, you know, it was easier to know all the different channels on the network based on knowing just one or two. And people would tell me all the time, like, oh, I watched you and then I found Jared, or I watched The Completionist and then I saw your channel, or something like that. And, you know, especially when we go to conventions together, we get those kind of stories a lot. But I think in 2017 specifically, it's more just like a group. It's almost like a boy band that doesn't sing. Like, we just go to, like, conventions together, and we can be like, you know, obviously we've only been doing this for a little bit now, but we just went to Indie PopCon together, and we were able to just be like, hey, we can all of us, all the Normal Boost guys, can come to your show. And kind of like, instead of like pitching just one or two, like, hey, can I come to your convention, like, we kind of go as a group. And it helps with, you know, things like that.
What ties together the, I guess, individual entities in your mind? Is it a similar work ethic? Is it the friendship? Is it just how well you seem to work, or at least communicate cohesively as a group? What do you think it is that draws these, let's see, six individual shows together versus, you know, like, what's the strength there in your mind? I mean, because you have lots of other websites that have loosely affiliated YouTube channels, but what is it you think that makes your group stand out, at least in your mind, or why it works?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think we just get along and, you know, we respect each other, but we also just have fun hanging out. And we don't see each other that often throughout the years, but when we do, you know, we all hang out and have a great time and, you know, go out for drinks at night and just, like, do the stuff that buddies do at conventions and things like that. So I think that's probably the thing that keeps us together more than anything.
Plus, there's the goat rituals that happen every now and then, I hear, you know.
The goat rituals, yeah.
The sacrifice.
We weren't supposed to talk about that.
That was off limits.
You're gonna edit that out. We don't do our, like, no, that's definitely no goat rituals. Definitely not.
Was there ever a time to go behind the scenes? I'm guessing when you added shows in the past, it probably had to be unanimous. Was there ever someone that maybe some of the group wanted as part, but then maybe a couple didn't? You don't have to say specifically who.
Yeah.
Someone like, oh, you know, that Pat guy, he seems pretty cool, but then two people like, nah, Pat's an asshole. He ain't. Was there ever a point that happened with the YouTuber?
We were, back in the day, obviously John's not a part of Normal Boots anymore. But we, back in the day, it was basically me and John didn't have very many rules. Pretty much the only rule that we worked together well, in a sense that we were both laid back, but at the same time that also had a lot of flaws, because we didn't, like, we weren't good at managing things, and also we were young kids, basically. But we basically had a rule where both of us had to agree on it, or it didn't go. And that there definitely was a couple times where it was like, hey, what do you think about this? And it was like, nah, and like vice versa. So it's just like, all right, well, there you go. Because that was the end of the discussion, because that was sort of how we had set it up. Like, that just is the way it is. If he didn't like it or I didn't like it, then it was a no-go.
Do you ever see your group adding someone else? Or are you guys satisfied with having sort of a small elite group, so to speak, that this is cool, we can roll with this, it's not going to get out of hand, having 20 or more channels involved? You're comfortable with where you're at?
I wouldn't say elite, but
there's certain websites and groups where, you know, that there's a certain I guess top tier of talent versus everyone else that's gotten lost in the shuffle. Like, Channel Awesome is the best example.
I think that we have definitely talked about it. It's not off the table. But that is kind of something we decided early on, where it was like, the more people you add, the harder it is to keep everything functional and, like, keep everybody happy. And, like, you know, you have too many people and some people aren't seeing spotlight or whatever. And so we always thought it would be easier to just keep it smaller. We did kind of learn, I think, from other websites, like you mentioned, like getting too many people, and then it was like it kind of you kind of lose like what even is normal boots if there's 25 people in it, you know?
Sure. Well, let's talk about that. What does that exactly mean, keeping everyone happy, in terms of a mostly loosely affiliated group of YouTube channels that, in your own words, don't even see each other for a chunk of the year? So what behind the scenes do you have to watch out for, do you feel?
That's a good question. Honestly, not that much anymore. Back in the day, it was being featured on the website, I guess. Like, you know, whose video's up on the front. We kind of just did it based on who uploaded last, as opposed to some other websites that would do like six uploads every day, and then they would choose who went on first, you know, on the like old website scroll thing that they used to use.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, today I don't. What was the question again?
Keeping everyone happy, and that sort of scrolls into, I guess, managing in a lesser degree egos and issues that might arise with people feeling slighted in terms of having a group structure.
Yeah. To be honest, there's really not none of that anymore. Like we basically split, like we don't, Normal Boots in and of itself doesn't really make money. I mean, everyone makes money on their individual channels. But we do sell merch and stuff, but we've gotten to the point at now, where we just split all of it evenly. Cause none of us, like the bigger channels don't really care. And you know, cause you know, we're doing our own things and we want to, and then the smaller channels can kind of benefit as well. So we just split everything evenly, as far as merch sales and things like that. So that's kind of how we avoid that whole problem. Cause that was always the big thing. Well, it's like, if there's money in something, that causes problems. But, and that was kind of why we were able to bring Normal Boots back, I think now, is because we all are doing our own thing and Normal Boots is just an extra thing we do. And half the time it's just an excuse to hang out and party at conventions or whatever. So that's kind of how we keep people happy now. But, you know, back in the day, it really was like exposure on the website. And, you know, if you get too many people on, you're getting a mix of personalities that don't, maybe they don't get along as well. And, you know, I don't know. Certain people expect certain things. We did have certain things in the past where people joined Normal Boots and they thought and they wanted I don't know what they necessarily expected, but they wanted something. I don't know. And then we weren't able to deliver it because we were just two 19-year-old idiots doing our YouTube channel and we didn't really think things out. So like that kind of was. I don't know. I'm having trouble answering the question because I don't really know if there really is a way we do it now. It's just. Everybody's just been on, and that's just the way it is. So it's almost like it is sort of more like a club, like a Normal Bitch club, really, than anything else. But that isn't to say that we wouldn't add people. It's something we've talked about.
I've heard you guys have killer members only jackets that you get once you're a member. So I'm...
we've talked about getting jackets. That would be cool, but we don't have them. Like a Asagao Academy jackets or something like that. And we wear them to conventions, but then it'd be so hot. Ugh.
I think it should be like the movie The Warriors, where every YouTuber group has their own like uniform they show up in to rumble. You know, like some have a top hat, some wear like pink velour jackets. You know, it could be fun.
Man, Normal Beats Wrestling Show, we got to do it.
So you enjoy the convention circuit? Is that something that you've grown to love, or does it wear on you from time to time? Doing all the conventions.
To be honest, I am fairly introverted. I like going to conventions for sure. If I go to too many for too long, it drains me big time. Because too much social interaction makes me a little tired. I love meeting people and I am always super grateful to do it. So I wouldn't say I love the convention circuit as in like going to a whole bunch of cons. I know like Gerard does that a lot. Jared goes to a lot of cons. That personally drains me. But I do love going to cons every now and then, like 2 or 3 a year. It's kind of if I can keep it to 2-3 a year, then I do love it.
2 or 3 a year. Okay. That's a slight schedule, I guess. If you don't have to, and if it's not for you, some people are built for it definitely more than others.
Yeah. Gerard is one of those people.
Gerard's like, a machine.
Super. He has way more energy than I could have. He has more energy in a year than I have my whole life, I think.
I've seen Gerard, see him, like at the beginning of the day, and then I'll see him 6 hours later. And like, yeah, I just talked to like for 5.5 hours with a group of fans. I'm like, oh my God, Gerard, I don't know how you do it. Like, you should be knocked out now. Yeah, some people are definitely more comfortable with it. I won't get into specific YouTubers that I know, some that tell me privately, like, yeah, I really don't like doing it that much, I have to, versus others that really relish the experience. I guess for someone like me, it's part of the job, just in terms of if I have to, you know, sell my book, for example, I have to go to the convention to sell it. I mean, it just makes the most sense to do that.
Yeah.
So, for example, last year I went to like 10 to 12 conventions, and it just wore me out. But I chose it. I had to do it.
Yeah. I feel that. I consider it part of the job as well, if for no other reason than to just meet fans, for sure. Or, I don't even like using the word fans. I don't usually say that, but just to meet people who watch, you know, your stuff. I
people
just feel like,
who enjoy, people who consume your content, content consumers.
Yeah.
why
I don't know.
You,
I've always had an aversion to the word fan for some reason.
Why is that?
I don't know. I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Is it too, does it seem like it's too,
it's like, it's going, oh, my fans. Yeah. I don't know. It's just like, I don't, realistically, there's nothing wrong with it. Like, cause that's, you know, that people are fans of your work, but I just, I don't know. I caught myself saying it, and I don't like saying it.
Is it a self-conscious thing where it's almost like,
yeah,
I mean, you don't want to seem too self-complimentary, even just saying, oh, I have fans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it is sort of, yeah, kind of that self-complimentary thing. Also, it's just like, I don't want to presume everyone that watches my videos is a fan of me. They just might just watch it every now and then or something like that.
Sure.
Or even people I meet at cons, like, they could just be like, oh, you're that guy. Like, they might not be fans. I don't know.
I see what you're saying. So you're saying that even if I have 1.7 million subscribers, maybe half are fans, or some subscribed and watched three videos.
Yeah, you know? Just trying, some are dead.
Some
are dead again.
Yeah, that's gonna. It's
that's
gonna be
sad to think about, but
hey, in 50 years, you're gonna have some YouTubers with, you know, 500 million subscribers, and yeah, some will be dead. You'll have 20 million will be dead. It's gonna be confusing. To know that, right?
Yeah, when I'm 70, I'll be like, oh, man, I'm still going on YouTube. Only 80% of my subs are dead.
Yeah, that's how you'll be generating your popularity. Well, 5% of my subscribers still watch my videos, or 1%. do you see that as the long-term career path for yourself? Do you see yourself doing YouTube videos 20, 30 years from now? Do you see that as what you want to be doing?
Not really. I mean, I not to say that I have any plans of quitting. I just, it's hard to imagine that I would still be doing it in 20 years. Like even 10, I hope, but I don't know. But to me, it's more about, will people even want to watch like 5-10 years from now? That's like, I mean, 10 years is a long time. I mean, I've almost been doing YouTube for 10 years, and so many things in my life has changed. It's hard to imagine that more things wouldn't change in 10 more years. But, I mean, ideally, yeah, I'd still be doing it, and I'd still be growing, and people would still be liking it, and I'd still be enjoying making the content. But 20 years, I don't know about that. I feel like Peanut Butter Gamer might fade away after 20 years. You know, that doesn't seem realistic to me.
Do you see
could
that,
be wrong, though.
Do you see there being maybe, for most YouTubers, a certain career path or arc where you'll have some that'll stick it out for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. They'll be 80 years old doing it. Maybe some go into behind-the-scenes production, or they start managing channels, or just doing something off of YouTube. I'm trying to think of a good example. Someone like Greg from Kinda Funny has flat out said in the future he sees himself just being behind the scenes and just running a company versus being on-air talent. So maybe it's a path that will find certain YouTubers, or the opportunities present themselves. Like maybe an opportunity you see coming to you where, all right, I'll start doing this differently. It doesn't have to be even having to do with content creation. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it's writing. Maybe it's directing something, you know, or maybe it's, I don't know, going into accounting. I don't know. Whatever interest you have out there.
For me personally, I think that I would actually prefer being behind the camera. I don't know how many people know that. I don't really like being... I thought back in the day when I was young, I would go to like conventions and I'd be like, man, that would be so awesome to be like on the stage and, you know, people want to talk to you. But then I realized later that that's really not me. I would rather be behind the camera. In fact, that was one of my favorite things, was like cinematography. I wanted to learn about that in school and like maybe like be some kind of director or something. Not to say that I would be a good director, but I do kind of prefer writing and being behind the camera, even behind the mic. I don't mind being like doing voiceovers and stuff like that. I've always been comfortable with that. But so, I mean, I could see that happening. I think that would probably be something I would enjoy a lot. I don't know who would want to hire me, though. So.
Well, do you see in the current YouTuber environment, I guess, in the ecosystem, are there a lot of opportunities presenting themselves to YouTubers to even try something different? Or are most YouTubers being pigeonholed into, okay, well, this is what you're good at right now, so this is what you're going to be doing?
You know, that's a good question. I do know – I have noticed that, like, some channels – I have noticed you mentioned some channels like dying off or like moving on to other things. I have seen some of that. But I think we probably have to wait and see a little bit longer to see like some of the channels that are, have really been doing this for a long time for a living, you know, what will they do, in the next few years? Honestly, I'm more interested to hear the answer to the question more so than I have an answer to it.
But in a perfect world, though, you would like to still be involved with creation, but maybe write, direct, and I guess work with others more so than, hey, I'm the one-man show writing, directing, starring, editing in my Peanut Butter Gamer videos.
Yeah, that would be ideal. But I still don't have any plans of quitting doing my YouTube videos by any means.
You heard it here first. You heard it here first. Peanut Butter Gamer quitting YouTube.
In 20 years.
So it's obviously something you still enjoy. But it might be preferable to sort of change it up at some point. I guess it's fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I wouldn't be surprised if in 10, 15 years I was tired of doing it. I'm not right now, though. I'm just sort of speculating.
Sure, absolutely. Obviously, you're still fairly young. Things can change. Your interests can grow. Opportunities.
Don't have kids yet.
You don't have kids yet? Hey, that might force you to stick it out, though, with your job. Hey, you got to make that.
Maybe so.
You've seen college. You know what the loans are like. You got to get that college fund going for those five kids you're going to have. You know, that's how it works.
That's pretty much the only thing that drives me business wise. I've never cared about business. I just like making videos. But anytime I'm thinking anything business, like, oh, someone approaches me with a brand deal, anything like that, I'm like, kids, I'm going to have kids. Like,
well, Beth. Well, let's get into that because, you know, being a YouTuber isn't just about creating content. It is about being – you have to be somewhat savvy as a business person on your own. And let's talk about brand deals. Okay. You know, they've always been around, but I've seen them become more prevalent due to, quote unquote, the adpocalypse and other things going on. How do you feel about that? How have your fans reacted to brand deals and sponsored videos? You know, stuff like mobile apps, for example, and games like that. Have you seen there been any backlash? Or have they been open to that? Have the followers been more open to brand deals based upon the current YouTube environment?
Yeah, it seems like it. I think viewers understand now more than ever in the past that, you know, doing YouTube takes a lot of time. It's not as easy as maybe people thought back in the day, you know, depending on what kind of content you're making, obviously, but it can take it could take me 2 or 3 weeks to finish something. Like you with Pat the Anius Funk, you know what that's like. It's you, especially if you really care about it, like you want to make it as good as you can make it. And that takes time. You got to script the content. You have to come up with ideas, first of all. You got to script it. You got to play the game if you're playing a game. Take notes on it. I usually do like 3 or 4 drafts of my script before I'm finished with it. Then you got to record the voiceovers. You got to film, and then you got to throw it together. It's like, it's a big thing, and honestly, the hardest part is just, for me, is getting the script finished and ready to go to where I feel comfortable starting on the rest of it. Then it's just sort of a work. You just work to get it done at that point. But
so you see the brand deals as sort of hedging your bets against the reception and or views revenue of doing the bread and butter videos on your channel. So it allows you more freedom that, okay, if I do this brand deal, obviously it's not the content everyone is looking for, but hey, it gives me more carte blanche to go out and try something that might take 2 to 3 weeks to put together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually did just do, I seem to get like offers in the summer. I did a handful of brand deals for a couple months. And now I'm kind of at the point where people were really cool with it for the most part. Like, people understand. And now I'm like, all right, well, I'm just going to do whatever I want for this next video. I'm literally doing something. I have no idea how many views it'll get. It's just something I wanted to do, and we'll see how it goes. But it's like, maybe without that, I would have felt like, oh, I got to do something else. Like, I got to do a hacking video or something I know is going to get a lot of views or something. So that is something that helps with freedom, like creative freedom and just doing what you want without worrying about paying the bills by making some kind of buzzy, you know, video that's going to get a lot of clicks.
Peanut Butter Gamer killed? Click to find out. You know, it's like, what? Well, he edited it. That's impossible. So definitely you felt the audience has matured. I mean, I personally have seen it where the first two or three brand deals or even sponsored videos you used to get killed for doing those like yeah. 3, 4, 5 years ago. It's like, yeah. how dare you do this? And I think with the advent of many people now, younger people, teenagers growing up, not watching TV as much, I think they realize that this is how it works. This is how it has to work. You either have sponsored videos, you have advertisements. I mean, that's just the way you have to, sort of support entertainers. That's just the only way to do it.
Capitalism, yo.
Yeah,
that's what we got going here.
Oh, that's what you got going. My brand deals are few and far between with my content, but it's still fun though. Obviously, how have you seen your own content change throughout the years? I mean, I can imagine myself starting doing videos. I mean, when I started doing videos, it was 2008, so I'm in my late 20s. But I even have seen my own writing mature and change. How have you seen that in your own work over the years?
I've for the past few years, I've always tried to have a mix of the old and kind of the new. I try to focus on every now and then. I will go back and watch. I know some people that like never watch your old stuff, but I do specifically go back and watch it just to see, like, you know, make sure I know what was working for me then. Like, I want to get that same kind of feel, but I do sort of evolve. I do think I have evolved my content a lot. And I think of it as, I think, the scripting. I'm more detailed in how I plan everything out. Whereas before I would just kind of, let's play Yoshi's Story and I'll just like do whatever. And you know, there is some charm to that though. And I try to make sure I don't lose that sort of carefree, do whatever you want kind of thing. Like, you don't want it to feel too scripted, like it's too planned out. But at the same time, I want to add more things and like make every video feel special and like I really put effort. Like, the thing that gets me the most is if I upload a video I spent a long time on and someone says, oh, this video seemed lazy. Like, that's the one that gets me. Like, that's what I don't want to feel. I don't want people to feel that when they watch it. So I don't know if my content really has changed all that much. If anything, I think I just put more effort into every video and try to get better over time while still keeping the same charm, which is not easy to do if you've been doing it for so long.
When you see a comment that says your content's lazy, do you take that personally or do you just have to shrug it off?
Oh, I mean, you just have to shrug it off. I don't. I mean, I take it personally in the sense that I take the criticism. And even if to me, if criticism irritates me, it's valid. That's kind of how I look at it. So if I see someone that says something that like makes me go, makes me kind of irritated, like, why would you say that? It's like, well, there must be some truth to it. So that's when I see someone saying something like that, I try to think, what am I doing wrong? Like, I must have done something. I mean, obviously, if it's just one guy, you can only take that. You know, you're not going to please everybody.
I was going to say, if it's one comment, you're constantly then sort of catering to the mob, but
absolutely.
Versus if it's like, yeah, if it's like 50 people saying the exact same thing about a certain joke or video, I can see that. That's what you're saying though. Not just one person says something like, oh my God, he's right. That
yeah,
person
absolutely.
Is right.
which is why I say only if it gets to me. Like, if I upload a video that I know I really liked and someone's like, that sucked, that was lazy, I'll be like, eh. Like, but if it gets to me, then there must be some truth to it. So that's kind of when I start to self-reflect and try and see, you know, did I really do everything I could on this? Maybe I could have done something better, you know, that kind of thing. I think back in the day, I was very, like, I would see criticism, and I would just be like, eh, and I would just get irritated by it. And I think I've maybe matured a little bit where I'm like, you know, these are people watching my videos. Like, I want to, you know, I may not change just from one comment, but, you know, I want to make people happy. And that's pretty much the thing that I fall back on whenever I'm doing my videos. It's like, I want to make as many people happy as I can. While still making the content that I want to make, obviously entertaining yourself to me is kind of the most important thing.
Interesting. Right. So at the end of the day, when you're writing and you're creating, you're basically doing it for what you would enjoy seeing and watching.
Pretty much, because like you said, it's hard to please other people, and I don't really know, like, that's something that's changed over time for me too. I stopped making videos for other people and made them for me, because I don't really know what other people want to see necessarily, but I know what I think is funny, and so I just try to do that. I try to do a video. I try to make myself laugh, and then hopefully other people like it. And my favorite videos are the ones that I look back on a few months later and be like, I had a lot of fun doing that one. And that's kind of how I judge whether a video was a success or not, so to speak.
Let's talk about your Goodwill Games series. How did that come about?
You know, because I did the first one a while back, and then it took a little bit before I did another one. So I don't really remember what my initial thought was. But I've always loved going to thrift stores. Like, I would watch other people, like, go on YouTube, go to thrift stores. Like, you would do your thrift store. What's the show called? Thrift Store Madness or something?
Close. Flea Market Madness.
Flea Market Madness.
Half
that's
credit.
It. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, no, I would see people like you going to thrift stores. And I actually didn't know of Clint at the time. But Lazy Game Reviews, he has a cool show where he goes to thrift stores now. I like to watch that. But I've always loved going to thrift stores. Just like the idea, I used to try and find retro games, but eventually you stopped finding, you know, obviously you can go to like a flea market or something like that, like you do to find retro games. But I usually would just go to thrift stores. But it instead of becoming like going there to find retro games, I would just find this the weirdest stuff. And I'm just like, what is this? And so I'm just kind of fascinated by stuff that I find at thrift stores. And to be honest, it's one of my... I don't have a whole lot of free time anymore, so I never really know what to do with it if I have like take like a Saturday off or something. But one thing I do know I could do and have a good time is just make a run at all the thrift stores. And sure. So, you know, when you do YouTube for a living, everything you like becomes content, basically. So that's kind of how I started it. And I guess that was my original inspiration. I don't really remember how I came up with the idea. I think I had it. Excuse me, I got the hiccups. I think I had the idea in my notebook for a long time before I did it, and then I was just like, I'll just do that. And so it was just kind of a thing I did, and then later I realized that, you know, that was pretty fun. I'll just do more of them. And now it's weird because I did a poll a while back where I was like, of all the shows that I do on my main channel, what's your favorite? And Goodwill Games ranks last on polls, but it still gets more views than some of the other videos. So I don't really understand what that's about. But I enjoy making those probably more than any of the other ones on a consistent basis. Like, I always enjoy making those because I can just talk about whatever I want and it doesn't have to be popular. You know, it helps if I can put Sonic on the thumbnail or something if I'm talking about like Sonic, if I find like Sonic Schoolhouse or something.
Sure.
But, you know, realistically, I can talk about Mia, the like child's learning game that I didn't even know what it was when I found it. And that's kind of what's fun about it is, you know, usually YouTubers do stuff about things they know stuff about. Like, oh, I love Zelda, I love Mario, or whatever. But, like, who loves Mia? Like, I didn't even know what that was. So you don't even know what you're getting into. And that's part of what's fun about it.
You're kind of going into the game's cold, so to speak.
Totally. And it's like, is this even going to be worth doing a video? I don't know. Let's put it in and try. It's kind of...
I got to steal your idea for flea market games then. Because, yeah, there's so many weird-ass games I find that I pick up that I would never dream of playing, like the Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen, you know, games that are out there for the GameCube or whatever. I would just find these at just the flea market, and you don't know these games even exist until you see them, like in front of your face for $1.50. And it's like, oh, that's really weird and interesting. You know, let's go for that. I guess that's part of the fun, right? Going out to the flea market or thrift store because you don't know what you're going to find. It's like a treasure hunt. You can find something really good, or you can still find garbage that you might think is interesting and pick up for cheap.
Sometimes the garbage is the best find if you look at it with the right eye. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, sure.
It's like, yeah. And then there's the best part where is when you go to the cashier and there's just like girl about my age and I'm cashing out like Hannah Montana, Elmo 123, and a Cheerios game. And it's like, what the heck is wrong with this guy? And I'm like, whew.
She's giving you like the side eye, like, what? This person's insane. What are they doing?
It used to bother me, but I stopped caring about stuff like that a while back. It's just like, whatever.
I was going to say, so you find these PC games, is it troublesome sometimes trying to get them working properly, like using a DOS box or, you know, games that are like 10, 20 years old?
Yeah, that's the only not fun part of it. I have a Windows 98 virtual PC now that's usually pretty effective. But every now and then something like the sound won't work, and it's a big pain to try and fix it. That's the only part of it that's not fun.
So, yeah, I guess that's you have to have, like, a rig set up, yeah, just for these old-ass games. Because these aren't – you're not going to see, like, some of these educational games on good old games to download for $4. So,
yeah.
It's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
That's just interesting. When I saw that the Goodwill Games here, I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. That's where we have a sort of small connection in our hearts as content creators.
Yeah, we should go thrifting sometime.
Hey, you know what?
Take me to flea market.
If you're ever out in San Diego, or if, I'm trying to think the next time. I used to go to – I went to PAX Prime – well, now it's called, what, PAX West back in Seattle. What was that? I went there, like, twice. Like, I've been there, like, 5 years now. But, hey, next time
– there anyway.
Well, let's see. I might see you in Portland if you come back.
I have made specific plans, but, I mean, I have gone the past few years, so.
And then maybe I'll try to get you out to the SoCal Retro Gaming Expo. We're going to do that maybe next year. But I remember I felt so bad just because we never get to really speak about anything ever. And the one time I had the opportunity in Portland, do you remember the state I was in when I saw you at Portland that, like, Friday night? I think your hotel room was like one or two next to mine. Do you remember that?
You were tired, right?
Yeah, that's to say the least. I had just gotten, I think, back from setting up all the books at the booth, and I remember I was out of my feet, and I was staggering around. I think my water bottle was in my hand, and you opened the door, and you were so nice. You had like, hey Pat, we got some pizza. Why don't you come on in and hang out? I remember mumbling something like, long day, tired, go to bed, and I was probably asleep within like 3 minutes of that conversation I had with you.
Falling asleep in the middle of the reply.
Yeah, it was just a sort of one of those things where I was like, oh, I feel awful now because, you know, you asked me to hang out and never get to see you, and now I was just out.
Nah, I didn't think twice about it. I mean, I if I see another guest at a convention and they look tired, I know what's up. I know what's wrong with you. You're either really tired or you're really hungover, depending on the time of day.
Yeah, I wish I had time and energy to be hungover at convention. It's just rough.
I'm getting to the point where I'm not sure if I'm young enough to make it work anymore. Like, I used to be able to, like, whatever, and just get up in the morning, and now it's like, ugh.
Well, back when I was your age, I would say about 26, 27 is when I officially was like, ooh, I'm not sure I can do this anymore. Yeah. I'm not sure I can sit up till 3:30 drinking. I just it's not in me anymore. I think that's when it started happening.
It's a nice
age.
Slap in the face where you're just like, what happened? I thought I could do anything. What's wrong with me?
Yeah, I think there's a limited shelf life for that amount of partying. at least in my eye. I'm sure if I had to do it like once or twice a year, I could get up for it. But no, I can't be doing that anymore. Like, long gone are the days at MAGFest where, we can stay up till like 4:30 and party every night. It's like, nope, can't do that anymore. I won't be able to get up.
Yeah, at Indy, we had this one normal – I didn't mean to change the subject. I'm really good at that,
go for
if
it.
You haven't noticed. But we had, it was our one, like, okay, one night we're going to have like a really, like, we're going to go to a nice place and like have a dinner and, you know, drinks and stuff. And it was not me ordering it, but someone kept ordering wine and drinks. And I'm the kind of person you put in front of me, I'll just have it. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna, okay. And kind of person. And then like the next morning I woke up, I did a signing at 10, which is really realistically not that early, but early if you've been up all night.
That's early for a con. That's very early.
Yeah. And then I had a panel right after that. And then we had a show later, and, oh man, that first hour of the 2 hour signing, I put on my professional face. I was doing it, but like every 10, 15 minutes I would turn around and just go, whew. And then turn around and be like, hey, how's it going? It's just like,
you need like a 5 hour energy drink like every hour.
I at one point I was like, Jacques, his Drudge brother, he was there helping us. I was like, Jacques, can you give me some Advil? And then people are like, are you okay? I was like, oh no, I'm fine.
Oh yeah, I'm fine. And you're just like slumping over.
Just like chugging water bottles. Nah, but it's all good.
Do you find yourself when you're doing these long signings? You said you're an introvert, so the energy to keep going, doing it hour after hour, and the drain on you. Does it ever get to the point where you have to find yourself not just going through the motions to try to make every person that comes up feel unique as an individual? Because obviously they come out to see you, they might be flying out across the country. Is that something you are cognizant of when you are talking to people?
Yeah, I mean, you always want to try to not zombie mode it. Yeah, like, I think when I first started doing some of that, it was a little harder because, you know, I'd never really done it before. I, like, you were talking about how you did, like, panels at cons, like, back in the day. I should have been doing that, but I wasn't, because I think part of it was I was too nervous. I didn't want to do a panel. I was afraid, you know, like, I was afraid maybe no one would show up. I was afraid that I would, like, choke on stage or something. So I waited way too long to do that kind of thing and, like, be, like, a guest at a convention. But so when I first started doing it, it was a little bit overwhelming, even when it was still small. But I think I did it. I've done it enough at this point that it's really – I've realized basically that people, when they show up to go to a signing, like this is kind of weird to say, but, like, I could say pretty much anything, and they'd be fine. Like, they're just interested in, like, seeing you. And, like, I'll do the most awkward things, and they'll apologize. And I'm like, no, I dropped the pen. And it's like, you don't have to apologize. It was me. Like, I don't know. It kind of reached a point where it's like, if you're awkward, sometimes you're both just awkward together. And if anything, that's just something that you can, like, connect with. Like, I'll be like, oh, sorry, I just am, like, blunt with people. Like, sorry, I'm just a little clumsy. I'm awkward. It's whatever. And then people don't seem fazed by it. But yeah, I mean, it's not a huge problem. Because everybody seems always has their own story. Sometimes people are shy, and that's just you just carry the conversation, and that's fine.
Yeah, but I always it's always tough because I try to make everyone feel like okay, it's not just giving everyone stock answers.
Yeah,
you know, people come out to see you. You know, you have to respect that. Obviously, they're spending money, they're spending time out of their lives to do that. But then you always see the one comment, at least I do every now and then, I was like, oh, I met Patty, he was kind of a douche. And I always feel like, wow, it's like I gotta watch it. I have to try to be extra nice. Obviously, if someone takes something the wrong way, and I can be sort of a punk sometimes, but you always have to be, you know, make sure you respect everyone that comes up to you.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
You always have to make sure that hey, they're there to see you. You know, you're in a state, you're in a position of privilege that someone's coming out to see you, to say hi to you. And so that's something that I don't think most YouTubers take for granted, but it's something I have to even remind myself at times that, okay, you should feel special that you have the opportunity to put in this position. So don't take it for granted, so to speak.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And that's why you get up at 10 a.m. even if you're like hungover from some mistakes from last night. Like, and that's kind of what I'm thinking when I'm getting up and doing that. And even that day specifically, I was like, well, these people came to see me. Like, I knew what I was getting into last night. Now I just have to do my part and get up and be there and put on a good face. And but I mean, it's fun too. And, you know, you meet people and like they're like someone, like, I don't want to say too much of the story because, you know, I didn't ask permission, but there was someone who like told this story about how she was ill in the hospital and she would watch our videos. I think who was I with Jared or Gerard at the time? And she started crying on the stage, and we just hugged her. And like, it's just like people, I mean, some people are just showing up, like I said earlier, just like, oh, hey, I saw there was a line. Who are you? Like, you know, that kind of thing happens sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Who are you again? What do you do?
And hey, that's an opportunity to be like, oh, yeah, you know, I do YouTube videos. Go check them out. So, hey, that's a new potential fan right there. But yeah, I mean, there is a sense of, you know, there is a genuine connection most of the time. And every now and then, obviously, if you're meeting a bunch of people, someone's, like I said, someone's shy, and you do have to have, like, a stock. So, like, how are you enjoying the convention so far? You know, but even then, it's just, like, it's just you trying to carry the conversation because they're nervous or, you know, whatever. Just that kind of thing. But, yeah, I don't know. It's a very rewarding thing. I talk about it like I don't enjoy it. It's not the case at all. It's just can be draining for an introvert for too long, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting that at least I always felt that I'm more of an introvert, and then I had to force myself to expose myself to, you know, the entertainment world. I forced myself to do improv a little bit in college, and that sort of made it easier to be open with myself in front of a crowd. But it's still a little bit of work to do that. And you can develop it, but it doesn't ever make it necessarily more comfortable within yourself. It really depends upon the person, obviously.
Yeah.
And how comfortable you are doing it. But it's funny, though, that you describe yourself as an introvert, and then you have, you know, up to a couple million people watching your videos. So at some point, you have to be comfortable with putting yourself out there for people to see you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you've crossed that boundary, at least. You've crossed that sort of obstacle.
Yeah. It's more practice than anything, honestly. Like, you do it for, I did reach a point as well, like you said, where I was like, you know, I say no to too many things. It's like, I'm just going to say yes more. So I'd be like, yes, I'll go to this convention. Yes, I'll go to this thing. You know, yes, I'll go on Pat's podcast. You know, like, just stuff like that.
Oh, was this a big decision?
Oh, no. Definitely not. But, you know, I mean, I did reach that point where I was like, yeah, I need to just start doing this stuff. It's like, every now and then I check myself with, will I regret not doing certain things, you know, 10 years from now? And, like, at one point, a few years back, going to conventions and stuff was one of them. I was like, I'll regret it. Like, because I remember 18-year-old me wanted to do a panel more than anything. But 24-year-old me has stage fright and horrible anxiety. So eventually I was just like, you know, I'm just going to have to do it. And if I pass out on stage, you know, that'll be a fun memory. Like, what I didn't want was regretting never doing it, you know? And that's kind of how I started going to cons like that. And, you know, after a while, like anything, you just do it enough and it becomes second nature. It's really not a problem.
Has there been a moment on stage where at a convention that you felt like a little mini panic or, oh my God, what am I doing? And you had to like take control back and be like, okay, I can get through this. It's okay. Has it ever happened to you where you felt like you're on that verge?
Yeah, definitely. We might be delving into an entire different conversation at this point, but I had panic attacks for like my whole life since I was maybe 9 or 10. I remember the first one I ever had was at a restaurant at night with my parents at downtown Dallas or something. And I had this really bad panic attack where I felt like I couldn't breathe. And especially back then, I didn't know why. I didn't know what like a panic attack was. So I thought like there was something wrong with me. And ever since that one time I had it, I started developing, you know, people use the word trigger, but like I developed like triggers. Like, oh, I had a panic attack at a restaurant with a lot of people at night. And so then it started every time I was in a restaurant at night with a lot of people, I would have a panic attack almost every time. And then I would have another one, you know, at a different place. And then so every time I would go there, I'd start to have panic attacks. And it developed into like just like straight up anxiety, like health anxiety, basically, where I felt like I was always ill. I always had something wrong with me. I was always I was having a heart attack at age 12. You know, I had asthma all of a sudden at age 15, you know, just like things like that. And it took me a long time to realize how weird your brain is. And, you know, if you perceive something as reality, it almost becomes that. Like, if you think you're sick, you're basically sick. And, you know, it took me a long time to get over that. And I think around 18, 19 is when I got over it initially. And then it came back after a kind of traumatic event a couple years after that on the way to the airport, which then became a trigger. So anytime I was driving to the airport by myself for a while. I've now kind of gotten over it. It's something I try to talk to people about, like viewers that like message me. I try to be open about it because I remember being a kid and feeling like I was the only one, you know, like and no one understood me. My parents didn't understand me, and my parents were great and they were super loving, but they didn't get it. Like, you know, they weren't psychiatrists or whatever you'd need to be to understand that. So they just knew that I always thought I was sick, and then I never was. So, you know, then people stop taking you seriously even, which can be even more discouraging. So I try to be honest about it and like upfront about it. But eventually I was able to, by myself, really, I didn't ever had therapy or anything, kind of overcome that and realize that it's all in your head. But things like that still come back even today. Like, I'll be on a panel. It usually happens with other people. When I'm by myself, I ramble, so I don't like have time to think about it.
You fill the air, so you don't have time to think.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm good at rambling, if you guys haven't noticed after an hour of the podcast so far. But, you know, I'll be sitting there and I'm like, oh no, what if I panicked? And you get that thought in your head and it all starts to come back. But I have kind of trained myself that, you know, 9 times out of 10, I can, everything's fine. Like, I know everything's fine. And you just kind of like convince yourself that everything's okay, kind of thing. So that happens sometimes. And you know, I've forgotten the point of the story at this point. But yeah, it does happen sometimes, even to this day. But that was definitely something that kept me from doing it and going to conventions and things like that initially.
So you're better now, and it's interesting you said that it was worse for you when you were with the group, I guess because you were sitting there at points not talking.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I expected it to be easier because you have a support group that could speak and bring up topics or make points instead of you if you had to. Interesting. Do you feel that the content creation helps with this issue you have? Is that sort of give you some sort of an outlet to get around some of this anxiety you experience at times?
I'd love to say yes, but I think it's the opposite, honestly. It's because you never leave your room, you know? Like, the thing that helps the most, like, as far as, like, active things you can do that's not in your head is leaving the house, getting exercise, you know, going out and, you know, socializing, things like that. So kind of if you sit around in your room writing all day, you know, that's, if anything, that's bad for your anxiety, or at least is for me. But, you know, that's my job, so... It is what it is.
So, how do you try to strike a balance? Do you put aside time per day, or maybe a few days a week, to go outside, to maybe go to exercise or take a walk? How do you deal with that?
I do try to exercise at least 3 times a week. But to be honest, my anxiety is not a huge problem for me anymore. I'm happy to say, and a big part of it was being able to talk about it. That's a huge thing. And that's kind of something I realized, which is probably why therapy would have been great when I was like 15. But just because talking about it and being open about it, you're forced to kind of acknowledge what it is. It's all just like basically a mental health issue, I guess. Like, and being able to talk bluntly about it for me has always been in and of itself some kind of therapy. But I used to not be able to talk about it, you know, and that was when it was bad, you know. I mean, I still get anxiety issues from time to time, but it's nowhere near the problem that it used to be.
Well, that's good. It feels like you are of a similar sort of maybe a similar track sometimes with my other podcast partner Ian, where sometimes the anxiety gets to him, but I think it helps him when he's public about it and speaking about it, because not just you can find solace, but then you I think sometimes you realize when you speak out about this stuff, you're actually helping someone else who either can't speak about it or doesn't, or it's hard for them to address it until they hear someone else talk about it.
Absolutely. I didn't mean to interrupt, but you said that and it reminded me just the other day, I had an email from a kid. Well, I don't know how old he was. I'm under the impression he was young. And he was telling me about how he had the same issue, and he was talking about it, and everything rang true with what I said. And then he said that he found one of my Tumblr posts or something where I talked about it, and he was saying how much it helped me. And, you know, people send me stuff like that all the time, like how much, like, my videos help them. That actually made me cry, though. Like, I was sitting there reading it, and tears were, like, forming in my eyes, and I don't cry very often. And even like, it was a couple days ago, and I have yet to reply to it because I wanted to reply to it so bad, and I'm going to. I have it open in a tab, but I didn't have the words right then, so I was like, I'm gonna wait until like a couple, you know, I was planning on doing it the next day, but I'm a space cadet, so I forgot. but like, that was just the other day, so that is a big reason why I talk about it, because I realize especially for young kids, people don't talk about mental health. Well, maybe more so now than before, but people don't talk about mental health a lot. And if you feel like – I just remember what it's like to be where he was and where he is. And I would have loved to have someone say, hey, man, I feel like that too, and it's not a big deal. Like, that would have helped me like so much.
So has that become maybe not your cause du jour, but maybe – I don't know, just by default, if you had to have something that you speak for or speak – some sort of cause, and that is, has that sort of become it, sort of mental health issues or anxiety in general, or maybe that's something that you've sort of fallen into as something that you publicly are in favor of talking about more?
Yeah, it was kind of a mixture of feeling obligated to and wanting to help people, and also in that, and when I first started being open and of itself, like I said, that in and of itself was its own kind of therapy. Like, just, hey, everybody, I have this terrible anxiety. It affected me most of my life, and it was kind of terrible. Some of my lowest points in my life, it was really bad. And then it's like, oh, wow, I said it. There you go. And it's kind of, that in and of itself is like, it makes it easier to deal with, just being open about it.
Yeah, well, it's freeing once you own something that you could, if you have the courage to talk about it and say, okay, this happened to me, it sucked, but hey, it is what it is. once you have the strength to do that, it sort of minimizes the effect, at least to me, when something bad happened.
Yeah.
Versus ignoring it or pretending it wasn't as bad as it really was.
For sure.
You know, but that's good that and I believe social media, one of the positive aspects of it is getting the word out for issues like that, like mental health issues, things like that. For example, when Justin Carmichael passed away, Jesus, what was that? Already 4 years ago already? Oh my God! I thought social media was helpful in getting the word out about depression and basically letting people know there was always outlets out there for you to talk to someone. Like it may not be as bad as it seems.
Yeah.
And to a somewhat lesser degree, panic attacks, anxiety issues, just letting you know that it's normal to have this occur. It doesn't make you strange or weird. It's not something wrong with you per se. It's just, it is what it is. We don't have control over these sort of issues at times. And mental health is just as important as physical health in a lot of ways. But let's talk about the other side, I guess, of social media, if we want to get into that. The drama that
the best
can occur.
Side.
The drama and the vitriol and sort of the divisiveness of social media. And you've certainly, I don't want to say I've gotten caught up on it, but you've definitely seen it firsthand how that could happen in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, there's tons of people out there and I guess I have always kind of, I don't think about my YouTube. I guess basically I don't think about how many followers I have very often. Like I kind of live in my own head and I just do, I'm always thinking about what the next video is. So sometimes you forget like how many people could potentially listen to or hear something you say. So even to this day, like I'll just reply to somebody on Twitter and I'm like, no one's going to see this. And then I'll look back, like, because I'm just, like, adding some rando guy I've never met before. And then, like, you look back, and then there's, like a day later, and there's, like, 20 likes on it, and, like, four people replied. It's, like, people are, like, looking at, like, my ats on Twitter. Like that's not, like, something that I think about very often. So, yeah, it can happen.
Sure.
It's a thing that can happen, Pat.
Was there one thing that happened in the past few months that stood out maybe or surprised you the response to?
I, you know, Pat, I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Well, we talk about partnerships of collaborative websites, and sometimes partnerships may change. They might be altered. Sometimes they might potentially end for various reasons. So I believe there was someone on Twitter that asked you straight up about your relationship with John, and your response to that sort of just blew up on Twitter. Which was very not surprising, but I think to some people it might have put in perspective, you know, sort of the reality of a situation versus the perception of something. And it's not, to me, it's not common for a content creator or YouTuber to be, I guess, as maybe not blunt or straightforward with an answer, and not as not as political as one may normally be with the response. Am I trying to dance around this more than you would? Or
yeah, I mean, it is what it is. Sometimes I'm usually pretty reserved. I don't like speak bluntly very often, but you know, every now and then I can be kind of hot-headed. I get it from my mom. Like I always joke around with her that I got her fire sometimes. I got my dad's like laid back, like who cares, like everything will be get done in its time. And then I kind of got my mom's feisty, high-pitched voice when I get irritated kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, obviously I know what you're referring to. That if anything, I typed that out in like 3 seconds. There was no thought put into that. Probably deserved more thought, more time, and more thought.
and just for the record, for those who know what we're talking about, I guess someone had basically.
It was Ethan, who I like. I like Ethan. I have no issues with him.
H3H3, correct?
Yes. I admire it, like how much not just how much he's grown, but like, you know, how fast and like how savvy he is with his content. But I've never actually met him in person, but I think he's, I admire him. So I have no issues with him, but he was irritating me in that particular moment.
He basically called you out for, I think not for backstabbing JonTron, for not having his, back.
No, basically his point was, why would you say something like, John said what he said, and I obviously didn't agree. So, and people were adding me about it and everything. Like, and so I kind of felt compelled to say, basically, I don't agree with that, you know. And I got a death threat based on what John said. I think the person thought I was him.
Referring to JonTron's political stances.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of done with all that, but which is part of the reason why I don't mind talking about it. But he was basically, why would you do that to a friend? And I just answered the question honestly, especially at that point. I was like, well, we weren't friends. We hadn't talked for, you know, like probably a year and a half, maybe. I don't know. I didn't keep track. And obviously that was a very poor way to answer that question, because I didn't elaborate further. And people thought that that meant that I had just sort of disowned him, which was not the case. Even at that point, I didn't have any, I had no particular ill will with John.
So at the time, you were just being truthful. I said, "Oh, we're not friends." So
from my perspective, he shared his point of view, and I was like, "Well, I want to share mine, and mine's the opposite of that." And that was kind of all that it was. And I think that would have been fine. But then once I said that, people took it as I had, you know, stopped.
They thought you disavowed him because of his views. When you weren't friends even at that point in time.
Yeah, or at the very least, I wouldn't have said that we were friends, because we, you know, normally friends speak, but that was part of the problem and part of the miscommunication, was that I didn't feel like I should say why we weren't friends. So it was something unrelated, and, you know, I wouldn't say it because I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I don't hate John. I wouldn't want to throw him under the bus and, like, try to say something and, you know, and like throw my side of a story out without having him say anything.
So from your perspective, you were answering a question truthfully, you were responding. But to the rest of the world, they were shocked that, oh my God, this is two partners that their world is not what we thought it was. And, you know, it's a war we didn't know about. They ran with that tweet, so to speak. As funny as that sounds, that's what happens though on social media.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you just get one little snippet, and then that travels, and that's all that travels. And you know, that's fine. I don't really care that much about it. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, like, people basically, my perspective on it is that people that are judging me don't know who I am, and they never will, so there's no point in trying to convince them of something that they're already convinced of. But for me, like, I got a lot of accusations, like, how could you, like disown a friend who, based on political views. And I tried to explain, I mean, some people listened, but some people just cared about the first snippet, and that just was what it was. But from my perspective, that's ridiculous, because I don't do that. And in fact, I disagree with probably 90%. I come from a family that actually completely disagrees with me on just about every political issue you can imagine. And I talk to him about it. I'll talk to him about, like, my mom on the phone about stuff like that. I don't care. Like, that's not, I'm just a blunt, in my, probably my personality in real life, I'm fine with just saying what I think. And that's really not a problem with me. So to me, that accusation was a little bit, I wouldn't say ridiculous, because I understand why they thought it was the case, but it's just like, to me, that's obviously not true. So what's the point in trying to convince people otherwise, when it seemed to me, from my perspective, that they weren't really interested in, or a lot of them weren't really interested in listening to me anyway. They were just mad that I had said something, and that was kind of their go-to. Oh, we can get him for that thing, that one particular comment. And
the perfect storm of maybe your bluntness versus the Twitter being possibly the worst place to have any sort of nuanced conversation.
Because
it's not even structured for that. 140-word limits. You can't really have – that's why I would say Twitter is the absolute worst place to talk about social or political issues overall. It's just so difficult to. So you got a little bit of heat from that, but in the long term, it is what it is, and it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it was just typical internet stuff. I mean, like, people just called me a social justice warrior, like, stuff like that, which is news to me because it wasn't that long ago that people that would have referred to themselves as social justice warriors were mad at me for stuff that I said. So it's kind of ridiculous when people insinuate that to me. But then again, it just kind of comes down to, like, how much effort do you really want to spend trying to convince people of something when you know, I just have things that I'm more interested in doing, obviously.
Absolutely. And to me, that's why when I see even my friends, or especially around, well, politics now is so divisive, but it always is around the elections. And then I see my friends or people I follow start tweeting and retweeting tons of stuff. I'm just like, well, it is what it is. You don't want to, once you start wading into it, you're sort of dragged down on social media. I have a sort of a theory of you got to stay out of it or you're all into it at that point. It's kind of hard to go in half tippy toes.
Yeah.
That's at least my perspective. I've definitely seen tweets and retweets and people liking stuff. And I agree with some of it. I don't agree with others. And it's just like, okay, this is not how I think I want to be using Twitter right now for the most part.
Yeah. And that's kind of why some of those assertions were a little ridiculous to me, because I follow a lot of people that will say stuff and I'm like, I don't agree with that at all. And then that's it. And then that's I go on with the rest of my day. I don't unfollow them. I think I probably only muted like one person that I can think of. No, two people for political stuff. And it wasn't because I disagreed with them. It was just because they were constantly arguing with people on their Twitter feed. And it was like just so much negativity on my feed that I was just like, I'll just mute them and unmute them later when all this stuff is over. But I don't like, you know, it's
well, the bad news, though, is that with what's currently going on, it hasn't stopped that much. Like, I remember after the 2012 election, it calmed down fairly quickly afterwards.
Yeah.
After that election, where I was like, okay, one side lost, the other side won. You know, it's back to semi-normal. But once you hit, like, 2016, and then with the election of the current president, and then with everything else going on, it just seems like we've reached this point where it's every day, not just random people, but people that I follow are tweeting political stuff. And at some point, I'm either thinking they got to get tired of it, or I'm going to have a mental break myself seeing it. And that's not to say talking about politics isn't important and social issues, but again, Twitter is not the place where I want to see that, at least personally.
Yeah, and it's just draining. I know for a fact, for me personally, it's draining. It's hard to be creative when you're drained down and all this like negativity and back and forth. And I think you're mentioning this election in particular. I think it was part of the reason why it's so divisive is the campaign on both sides were kind of, that guy sucks, vote for me. That lady sucks, vote for me. And that's kind of like, I mean, there were some policy issues here and there, I guess, maybe. But like, it was just like, if you vote for them, we're all screwed. Well, if you vote for them, we're all screwed. And so it's just like, well, if both candidates are running on this, then it's no wonder that's why it became so divisive. It's you know.
Yeah, it's when it's a campaign of, at least in my eyes, like, who do you hate less? Vote for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, oh, this is fantastic, this choice now in front of me. But you're right. The results of that being pounded into the electorate for 6-7 months is not good.
Yeah.
And then I feel, at least personally, I feel alienated by the entire thing. Or it's just like, okay, can I talk sensibly with someone? And again, you can, but just not to me on Twitter. That's just not the place to do it.
Yeah, and I think that's fair.
If it's hard to do that about frickin' video games, it's impossible to do that about politics.
Yeah, if you want to get some flack, say something about like Nintendo or something on
on
Twitter.
Or people coming after me because I was like, oh, hey, guys, I point out, oh, ThinkGeek has some NES Classic Editions left. And people go, oh, Pat, how can you support this? This is a form of scalping. I was like, oh, my God, I'm trying to give you guys the opportunity to buy one. Speaking of that, sir, I am jealous that you got an NES Classic Edition early.
I did.
And here I am. That's my bread and butter. I'm just like begging to get one early, and I couldn't make it happen.
I didn't even ask for it. I was thinking maybe they'll send me an SNES one. But they didn't.
Oh, rub it in, Austin.
Sorry.
I remember at Comic-Con, since Nintendo's always at the the hotel next to, I think, the Hyatt. They always had their Nintendo space set up. I remember going there 2 days trying to get the PR rep, and they were never there. I was like, I just want to ask for something. I was like, hey, listen, guys, I got this book coming out. I'm sort of an NES guy. I really appreciate if you can get me an early version of this at least, or something. And I couldn't even talk to someone there. I was like, ah, damn it. I'm not on the radar enough for Nintendo.
Did you get you got one now though, right?
Oh yeah, I managed to get a bundle. I don't begrudge GameStop for selling it, but I did get the bundle at the time where it came with the Nintendo guide they put out. Then I got the extra controller, which is actually interesting because those are impossible to find, the North American version of the extra controller. Those are like for some reason, those are like the hot collector items. You can find them, like the European ones, you can find all over the place. But for some reason, they didn't put out many in North America. So there you have it, the box version. What percentage of your gaming is retro versus modern, if you had a sort of have a delineation mark?
I assume you're referring to just like free time?
Oh, I guess in general. I mean, like, what do you see that as? Do you gravitate towards one, or do you feel like you have to do a lot of modern gaming to keep up with the times, and obviously because that gets more views? I mean, how do you see it?
As far as, like, what gets more views, to me, sometimes that's hard to tell. I don't really know, because it seems like I'll do, like, a video on a new Nintendo game, and it doesn't do well, and then I'll do a Goodwill Games, and then it gets, like, a bunch of views in, like, 2 days. So sometimes it's hard to say. For me personally, if I'm just playing a game, unless I'm playing something new, I play a lot of stuff on PC, then I tend to gravitate back to kind of N64, GameCube, Wii type stuff. I do play a lot of... I love playing Super Nintendo. I grew up playing Super Nintendo with my brother. And I do NES a lot as well, but my retro, quote-unquote, is like, oh man, back in the day when I would play, like, Animal Crossing on the GameCube. Like, that was, like, my big thing. Or, like, Mario 64 was, like, the first big game that I played and really loved. Like, that was... I mean, I played, like I said, a lot of SNES. I was born in 1990, which was the year the SNES came out. But my older brother had an NES and a Super Nintendo. And at the time, I didn't even really know the difference. I knew the NES was the older one, and then the Super Nintendo was the newer one. But to me, I didn't really care... It was just what me and my brother would go to the local equivalent of Blockbuster, like Video Hits or whatever, and be like, do you have any two-player at a time games? That's what we would like, so that we could like play like Final Fight or like something like that, so we could play together. But then to me, that's basically all games were at the time, and it wasn't really even old enough to comprehend much more. And then when I saw Mario 64, I was like, you can swim and there's fish. Like, I was just, like, running outside the castle. I was like, that's kind of when I first was like, man, video games. Like, this is something that you could really do anything with this. And that's – so, like, to me, that's kind of where I go back to that. If I'm looking for some nostalgia, I go to kind of N64 GameCube.
It's so interesting since we're that, like, one gaming generation apart, where by the time I got to N64, I was out of consoles and was playing computer games. Those were for mature adults. You got Blood and Doom, and, you know, you got full motion video boobies and stuff. You know, like that's basically what it was for me, because that was probably around when I was in high school. It was like, oh, you can play a console game, or you move on to, you know, take over the world in Civilization 2. And that was sort of my sort of gaming arc as a kid going into my teenage years.
For me, it was Call of Duty 1, the first World War II game. It was one of my first PC games that I played. I mean, I played StarCraft, stuff like that back in the day, and Roller Coaster Tycoon. But I didn't actually like play PC games on my own computer until about like Call of Duty 1.
Interesting. I think my big one was the first Medal of Honor game, where you're storming the beaches of Normandy. I think that was the first one. Allied Assault, was that the big one? Yeah, that was the big one.
I think I may have played the console version of that.
That definitely came out, I think, on GameCube and PS2, I believe.
Yeah, it was GameCube. I remembered Normandy and up the beach. It was like weird control, like analog sticks, which to me was all. I didn't know anything else at the time because I didn't play shooters really. The first shooter I played was Counter-Strike Source. But I played it at my friend's house. I didn't have like my own computer until I was a little older.
Interesting. So when you went to college, did you get your computer gaming on at that point?
It was more high school. I I remember getting my first computer maybe 8th or 9th grade. My parents were always a little slow and on like upgrading technology, and I mean, I had to save up my own money and stuff too. So I mean, obviously my parents helped me get my computer with like Christmas presents, but I had to work for it, kind of thing. But yeah, I definitely, once I got older in high school, I started playing WoW, stuff like that. And I remember playing Dead Space. When that was one of the games I remember playing when I moved out to college. I was really into Dead Space at that time.
Oh, that's the one where you're in space, obviously, but you're like a space marine. There's like ghosts and stuff.
You're not a space marine. You're an engineer. That was part of what was cool about it, was because you were just like this regular guy, and you didn't have real weapons. You had like, well, you could get some, but you mostly had like these weird futuristic engineer guns. And like, stuff like that. I think Dead Space holds up to this day, especially, you know, Dead Space 2 is a little more actiony, but Dead Space 2 is really good too. Dead Space 3, I barely played that one, to be honest with you. But I really loved the first two. I think they still hold up, but it might be my nostalgia talking. I don't know.
I think my cousin used to always play that. He used to mention to me, yeah, 2008. Yeah, he used to play that a lot. I was trying to get back into PC gaming. With Steam, it's easier. I have a nice gaming laptop. I still have to play Friday the 13th. It's still sitting. I bought it. I haven't played it yet. It's still sitting there. It's trying to, at least for me, maybe you know it, it's kind of hard to, you have all your energy going into playing these games for videos and reviewing them, and then on your off time, do you have the energy to go play games for leisure at the same time?
I definitely feel that.
It's tough because you want to be able to play games, at least for me, not to make it about me, but like, for example, when I was working on
your podcast.
Oh yeah, but you're the guest. But when I was working on the NES book, it was hard for gaming in general to be fun, because here I am playing hundreds of these NES games, and that's all for this, you know, book assignment. That it's all where no one's to me getting anything out of me playing these games. It's all internal until this book comes out.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a slog. I don't see any result of this for like, you know, a year and a half, 2-3 years. And so I know at that point in time, it was very difficult to then go from doing that and then relaxing and playing a game. It was just very hard to do that. It's just like, the last thing I wanted to do was play a video game at that point.
Yeah, I feel that. I think that's, maybe that's part of the reason why I like doing the Goodwill Game stuff, because I'm not doing like a video on a new game, which in and of itself almost kind of ruins the game for you a little bit, because it becomes work. Like, oh, I gotta play Breath of the Wild, and even though I'm super excited and have tons of fun playing it, eventually, even though I got it early, it's like, well, eventually, and now I have to start getting into work mode. And even while you're playing, I'm like stopping for 20 minutes to write some notes down and stuff like that. So then by the time you're done with the video, it's like, well, I'm finished with my work of this particular thing. And then Breath of the Wild is obviously one that is kind of an exception, but I don't know why I'm using that as an example. But so sometimes it's like, oh, I do a video on ARMS and I think it's really fun, but then I'm done with the video and I'm like, man, I've been working on this video for like really hard for like a week, 2 weeks, and so now I'm kind of done with it, you know?
Sure.
But with Goodwill Games, it's like, you know, I don't even know what this is, so I can just like work on that and then move on to playing whatever I like.
But yeah, I guess you can get sort of the leisure in there, because these are games these are silly games. You can kind of have fun and go through it. And maybe your fans don't, excuse me, not fans, your followers don't expect the same sort of rigor.
Thanks for obliging me.
They don't expect the same sort of reviewing rigor with a game like, I don't know, some random Schoolhouse Jams freaking educational game versus Breath of the Wild. Where you can just, it's almost like a mini vacation from real work, so to speak, for you. I don't know, but yeah. That's how I would look at it. I gotta ship you a whole bunch of crap I found at the flea market to play. Maybe we can do that at some point, because I don't have time to play the Mary Kate and Ashley games as much as maybe you or Barbie games or things that I find that I like.
I did do a Barbie game on the first one.
Oh, did you? Which one was it? You remember?
Barbie. It one of her mini jobs, Barbie Adventure something for the PlayStation 1. Like she, okay, it's Barbie Explorer. I just remember she goes, "I'm gonna be a world class explorer." I guess when you're Barbie, you can just say, "I'm just gonna do this now," and then you just are just a world class explorer now.
Hey,
you said.
It's an important message for the kids out there. I think I found the race horsing one at this swap meet once. That's probably one I should play at one point. But tell me, Austin, what do you have going on in the future? What's coming up?
Well, We have our I do some stuff on my gameplay channel now, and we have videos every day. I don't edit those videos. Most of my time is spent on the main channel. People to this day sometimes think I don't edit those, but the main channel videos, but I do. I have someone that like does the assembly edit, and then I spend like then I well, it in theory it saves me time, but it, sometimes it feels like it doesn't, because then it's still spend like a 2 15-hour days in a row to like finish it up. But so we have our hardcore series going on. I say R because I don't even really do any of the work for it anymore. I show up. my friend Todd does it, and he's really great, and he does really good work with it. But it was a show me and my brother came up with, where it's like you get a bunch of people, and they either complete a goal and win, or everyone dies and you lose. So it's kind of like a reality show where you don't know what's going to happen, and that's kind of what's fun about it. And you know, your favorite character, so to speak, can just die, and even I can just die in my own show, like in the first episode, and then I'm just like, if it's 20 episodes, I'm in like one of them. So it just it's like it just whatever happens happens kind of thing, which is fun because there's some unpredictability to it. But yeah, we're also doing PB and Jeff. We were mentioning how like sometimes it's hard to sit down and just play a game for fun. Honestly, that's part of what I love doing about that. Like, we're playing Pikmin 2 right now, and it's just a fun game. And even though we record for like 6 7 hours at a time sometimes, so it's gonna be draining, it's still a lot of fun and to just like sit down and play. Like, okay, well, I'm playing Pikmin today. Like, that's fun, you know. So we're doing that, and I'm working on another video. I'm always working on a main channel video. So working on it's actually a movie. It's the first time I've ever done a video about something that's not even not game related in any way, not even like a game cartoon. It's just a straight up movie. It's related to my channel now at this point, but I don't want to spoil what it is just yet because I'm not sure when this is coming out.
Movie review, kind of, sort of.
I mean, it's a straight up movie review. Yeah. It's if anyone who's like familiar with my channel would equate the content to me, like it's something that I'm known for talking about, but it's not video game related at all, which is a first for me. So we'll see how that goes.
Very interesting. And where can people find you on Twitter and on YouTube?
Twitter.com/peanutbuttergmr, because it didn't fit. think about that, kids. If you're one of those kids we were talking about early in the podcast where you're like starting your YouTube channel, think about your name length. That's important. Don't go too long. Also, don't call yourself Peanut Butter Gamer, because that's a dumb name.
it's already taken.
Yeah, it's also taken. I won't fight you. You can do it if you want, but it's probably not going to work out. Yeah, it's youtube.com/peanutbuttergamer. PVG gameplay.
Well, it was great to finally chat with you after my disheveled, tired state at Portland Retro Gaming Expo last year.
Well, I'll tell you what. If we go to Portland, we got to get some pizza.
We definitely got to get a slice in. I can't believe I missed out on free pizza. I cannot believe that's so not like me. All right, Austin, we should talk again soon and maybe do one of those dreaded collabs down the road. We'll see.
Yeah, let's do it. Thanks for having me. It was fun. So I don't even hear that. A garbage truck is sending me off, I think.
Describes my podcast well enough. So. Thanks again to Austin for speaking to me this week. Check him out. He's Peanut Butter Gamer on YouTube. If you enjoyed the Not So Common podcast, please consider subscribing on your podcast platform of choice. Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, or whatever else you use to listen to them. You can rate the podcast and leave a comment to help give it a boost, and also spread the word on social media to let others know how much you enjoy it. Finally, if you want to help directly support me and the podcast, please check out patreon.com/patcontry. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.